This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We're taping in the studio of KRVS on UL Lafayette's campus with the assistance of Operations Manager James Hebert. Our show is supported by our premier sponsors. First, I'd like to thank Iberia Bank. Founded in 1887, Iberia Bank is the largest bank based in Louisiana and is headquartered in Lafayette with 325 combined locations throughout the South. They offer the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit iberiabank.com for more information. We're also grateful for the support of Lafayette General Health. As Acadiana's largest nonprofit community-owned regional health system, Lafayette General Health is committed to restoring, maintaining, and improving health in the communities it serves. For more information, visit LafayetteGeneral.com. Cody Chamberlain, an award-winning writer and artist in the entertainment arts, is our guest today. Cody has written and illustrated comics and graphic novels for Marvel Comics, DC Comics, Dark Horse Comics, IDW Publishing, and Image Comics. He's also a writer and story artist for film, television, and video games, and this year released Maniacal, a new board game distributed internationally by Eagle Griffin Games. 2019 was a big year, as Festival International named Cody Chamberlain its official visual artist, and his illustration work was featured in a five-minute segment for NBC Universal's Oscar coverage for the 91st Academy Awards. Cody's original story work has been optioned for feature film development by Universal and 20th Century Fox. His feature screenplay, Smut and Jeff, earned a second-round spot at Austin Film Festival, and Vermilion, his original one-hour pilot, earned a second-round spot at both AFF and Sundance. His original crime series, Sweets, a New Orleans crime story, earned a Spine Tingler Award. Cody currently lives in Lafayette, Louisiana, with his wife, Christy, and their son, Lucas. And Cody, I stopped about halfway through your bio because there's so much I'd rather hear you speak about. So I want to welcome you to Discover Lafayette, and I want this show to be yours to talk about what it's like to have the successful business that you do based here in the South when you actually work with people internationally. Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've not met before. I knew your name.
I met briefly at a Chamber of Commerce event a long time ago, back in passing. When that was still alive.
Yeah, and I didn't realize the extent to what you do, but I think I really heard your name quite a bit last year in regards to festival, because that's such a big event. You want to maybe start with that? What brought you to be the festival artist and to design the poster?
For sure. I have a very interesting history with Festival International. It was actually part of the reason why I moved here. I started college at Nichols in Thibodaux. It's where I'm originally from. Mm-hmm. And I had some friends that had come to college here, John Crochet, lifelong friend, college roommate. And he was here going to UL in the music department. And I came in for a visit, and it happened to be around the time of festival. Mm-hmm. It may have been a week before or so, and I stayed. Ended up going to the festival with those guys, loved it. The town was great. Went back to Thibodaux, and the next semester had come around, and my drawing professor had resigned or had just moved on to another school, and they were sort of substituting with another teacher who just wasn't doing a great job. And I was attempting to be an art major and specifically drawing at that point, and just got really discouraged, and I was considering dropping out completely. And then I decided to come and check out UL's art, at that time USL, check out their art program. I met Dutch Kepler, really got to kind of tour Fletcher Hall and see who was in there, and Elmore Morgan Jr. was very prominent at the time as well. But I remembered festival. I remembered really the vibe of the town, how great it was out here. And it was really one of half a dozen things that helped me move out here.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you transferred?
I was in my halfway through my second year.
Mm-hmm. So that was a good time.
So, yeah, 20, yep. 20 right. years old or so, somewhere in there.
Right. So you ended up graduating with a Bachelor of Fine Arts, is that right?
I do have a BFA. Mine says USL. Uh-huh. BFA with a focus on advertising design with Professor Dutch Kepler.
Okay. So what is that? Is that the graphic? Like, what did you actually study?
It is. It's sort of a combination degree between advertising and graphic design. Mm-hmm. So, we weren't just making things pretty. We actually had to write. Mm-hmm. We had to write headlines. We had to write copy. We had to have strategy and planning and all the things that kind of go into it, more than just the aesthetic side of graphic design. So he really taught us to think. And what was interesting about that program at that time, he had little to no interest in software. The software was up to us. We can use whatever we wanted. We mm-hmm. can draw it by hand. We can use any platform. He only cared that it looked great and the work was well-crafted and the ideas were good. Nothing else really mattered. And I learned a really good lesson from that because I got out into the world learning to use Quark Express right at the time when Adobe InDesign sort of took over the graphic design world in that platform. Had to learn a whole new piece of software. So had he focused, you know, on software completely, I had gotten onto the world, I wouldn't have been prepared. Mm-hmm. But really, software was irrelevant by the time I got out and started working. It was more about the ideas, the techniques for creativity. And it served me really well. I've hopped around a lot of different fields, and I'm sure we're going to talk about some of that.
Yeah.
But using essentially the same skill set mm-hmm. in a combination of different ways.
So to finish that original thought on the poster for Festival mm-hmm. 2019, it's beautiful. Do you start with your sketch and then make it into a graphic file? Like, how does that work? How does your mind work when you're creating?
For me, a graphic design project or an illustration project, that was sort of a combination of the two. Even those really start with the writing. So I wrote words that I thought I associated with Festival. What are my big memories of it?
What were your big memories?
One of them was fusion, not jazz fusion, but the concept that many different things are fused together. Like, you may go and see there was a throat singing group that had a beatbox artist on stage with them. You know, that type of thing. Or mm-hmm. you might be eating a gyro sandwich listening to some group from Brazil, like this weird clashing of things mm-hmm. all in one place. And that always fascinated me. And I was also, I wasn't a major, but I spent a lot of time in the percussion department at UL. And we were all about fusion. We played Festival International when I was in college.
Bang on the drums all day.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we would do our percussion ensemble show, mm-hmm. Which would be anything from Japanese taiko. We'd do West African drum and dance. We do it all in one set. It was kind of this fusion. So fusion was the big word I honed in on, because a lot of people have a vision of festivals being one thing, but to me it's always been many things. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the world coming to Lafayette. And so I honed in on that really sharply. And that was really the genesis for me taking, you know, if people want to see the video, I'm sure we can link to it, but the concept of three different illustrations brought together mm-hmm. to form one piece. Mm-hmm. Unifying the colors. Some of that was already in the festival logo, so I embraced that and I used it in the design. And the idea that festival is also a destination. It's not simply about the music. You know, so many festivals I've gone to are just in an open field somewhere. This is in the very heart of Lafayette with mm-hmm. every business around, and you can pop into a restaurant or a cafe. It's a very unique festival, and mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of people know that.
Yeah.
So many festivals are held on fairgrounds where it's just a blank canvas where they can mm-hmm. build up the festival. This is really in the heart of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also wanted to zero in on that. So those were the two keys for me going into the poster. Great experience, great people. They really know how to pull a festival together. They're very supportive of the arts in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
They really supported the vision. I wanted to take some chances and try some things that mm-hmm. hadn't been done before. They're very supportive of that. So really an incredible experience.
I'm curious when you talk about, you know, taking chances and do you have to sell your idea up front, or do you draw it and then is there a review committee, or do you just present your work and that's it once they've hired you as an artist?
Well, they do have a submission online, so you do have to, I guess, apply to mm-hmm. be an artist, and there's some sort of an early review process. I don't exactly remember what I had to upload. There was a bit of an artist statement. There were maybe some links to sample work I think I had to put in. And so from there, I think they zero out anyone that maybe they don't think could pull it off, or maybe the experience isn't there for print. Because mm-hmm. there's some production involved in creating a piece that's ready for print. So I think they look at that, too.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit of, they did request a little bit of concept work. And I don't quite recall, for me, it's sort of a sliding gray from 0 to 100. So I don't quite remember where the landmark was. But I do remember some of this was in a very early pitch. And then when I was brought on as official artist, I was given about maybe a month or so to really develop mm-hmm. the vision for what I was going to plan to do. And I brought that in the form of a sketchbook, a custom sketchbook with everything in there from color palettes I wanted to try and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you get nervous before you show your work? Like, do you have, or do you feel like once you're there, this is it. You know what I'm saying?
No, I don't have the nervous gene. I've spoken in front of 3,000 people, and you know, I don't really have it. I will get a little bit excited sometimes for certain events. You know, like if I have a new comic coming out, we're doing a big signing, I do get excited because it's a big moment for me, but not so much in the way of nerves, you know, to where I think it would affect my speech or anything like that. So, but in that case, I also knew, because I had done a piece prior to that with Festival for David Egan and Rocket Dipsy Sr. So it was a tribute piece to them that's installed in the Festival building. So I had recently done that piece. And so that may have helped my chances a little bit in that. They saw it wasn't crazy. I was easy to work with, and the ideas came together, and we actually finished it on time. So I think that was also a little bit of a confidence boost for them to help pick me.
Well, the cymbals were crashing for you because you were also working on your art for the 2019 Oscars, right? The red carpet show. Was that a little bit prior? I mean, you were working.
Yeah, it was all at the same time. I believe I had completed the poster, but I was doing the pin, the cup, you know, all the other, the badges, everything that goes with it. I was also designing all of that, which is not always the case. The poster artist would typically hand that over to an ad agency or something like that, whereas my background also includes graphic design, so I just did it all. That was all going on at the same time, so I tell people it's a bit like spinning plates. You know, one starts to wobble a little bit, so you got to go over and give it some attention and hope nothing crashes down.
Right. You probably grew up seeing that on Johnny Carson.
Absolutely, yeah.
They don't always make it, though.
I don't know if the kids even know what that is anymore, but it all came together pretty good in the end. Nothing was late. Everyone was happy. Mm-hmm. So.
How were you selected for that? For the, I know that was shown. It was a five-minute piece, and it incorporated scenery from a lot of the movies that were focused on Marvel and the superheroes. So how were you selected for that honor?
Well, NBC Universal, the producers there, had a concept that since Black Panther was up for Best Picture, Spider-Verse was up for Best Animated, and Stan Lee had just passed, that they would do something comic book related. So I believe there was a little bit of an artist search to find someone that could maybe do. But also there was a graphic design kind of element to it that it had to be framed correctly and all this kind of stuff. And they had reached out to another artist, Mark Emery, who's an animator, a friend of mine, that reached out to him to see if he had some interest. I guess he was too busy or wasn't up to the task, and he referred me. And that's pretty standard. Almost every gig that I've ever had has been from a referral or someone specifically looking for the types of things I do.
You were talking about that before we started taping, that the best way to be, it's to be found and not to market yourself, like just to make sure that your work is visible where people can find you. But by the time they're coming to you, they want to work with you.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of truth to the idea that you have to let them think it's their idea that they found you. And the way to do that is to be discoverable. So you have to be in the right places. You have to worry about search engine optimization. You have to do as much media as you can to get the word out. I always try, when people ask me for a photograph, I put an illustration. I think you've seen it.
I love it. I mean, you can make yourself look however you want to.
Yeah, exactly. But it's one more way to kind of showcase what I do rather than just a picture of me, which no one cares about.
But it looks just like you, but yet it's just fascinating.
There's a likeness there, yeah, but it's more of like a cel-shaded comic style, I guess. Yeah. But even that, the profile picture is a way for me to reinforce the things I do and promote a little bit. So I try to be creative about the ways I promote myself, because I found that telling someone to hire me for a project doesn't work. If they hear it from someone they really trust, that means a lot more. If they're looking specifically for the types of stuff I do, that's also very helpful. So those are that's the two approaches I prefer.
You know, that's good advice for any of us in life. When you push it too hard, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, if you shove it at them, they'll resist it. You know, the defenses go up.
That's right. When we were talking, I have to confess, I didn't appreciate as far as have information about how many different types of work you do. So you're a writer, you're a graphic design artist, and you're an artist with your comic book work. And I asked you, you know, naively, which one do you have two side gigs and one main gig? And you said, no, they're all, I support myself through all of these endeavors.
Absolutely.
What is your main company? You've got a website that people can go to.
InkhouseCreative.com is my website, but I don't really use it in the industry. That's for me, it's more of a local thing. So I do.
You've got a blog.
Presentations, workshop, mm-hmm. people locally sort of looking to have something to hand out on a business mm-hmm. card. When I do work for publishers and things like that, I just use my name because that's what they want. They want Cody Chamberlain as the name because Cody Chamberlain has a fan base. And so the Inkhouse Creative is it's more local for Acadiana mm-hmm. than anything. Whereas my name is really the stuff I put on the projects that I do, the board games and the comic books and stuff like that, the screenplays.
I meant to mention that Maniacal just came out. I mentioned it in the intro, but this is your big 2020 news. You've got a new board game that's out.
It certainly is, yeah, one of the big projects. Originally created and written by Hassan Lopez. He's I'm trying to remember his career, but I think he may be an astrophysicist or something, something along those lines.
How do you play the game? Like, what did he come up with? I know you helped develop it.
Yeah, well, he built the game using what would look like Microsoft Word and Clipart. Like, he just kind of, you know, through sheer force of will, built a prototype of mm-hmm. what he wanted the game to be. And then he brought it to my studio mate, Rob Guillory, who's another comic book artist in town, because he really liked Rob. Rob has a really fun, cartoony style. And he really wanted that comedy element for the mm-hmm. game because there's a lot of comedy in the game. And so he reached out to Rob about actually drawing the illustrations for the game. And Rob recommended me, again, another referral, mm-hmm. recommended me for the graphic design for the game, which was extensive. So every little icon, every card, every shape, every color choice, mm-hmm. Very, very large game. The rule book is really large. And it just came out. It's doing really well from what I hear. We played it a few times and...
It's not like Monopoly. It's more detailed.
It has some things in common with Monopoly. I do warn people that it's not a game built for casual gamers. This is a game built for people that love board games, that play a lot of board games. You have to really enjoy the process of building a team and selecting your characters, and mm-hmm. that's all really part of the fun of it. It's not really a quick thing where you set up the board and roll dice.
Like two people. How many people participate?
We played it with four. Mm-hmm. I think it can go up to six, four to six.
Can you cheat?
Probably, yeah. Yep. I haven't, but it's...
I'm just laughing, thinking about Monopoly and other things. You couldn't let somebody leave, you know, you couldn't leave the room to go to the bathroom because somebody would always cheat, you know.
That's right.
At least
but
in
I think,
our group.
I think any game... You get to a certain point where there are sort of backroom deals going on, and I'm sure there's some of that happening.
That's pretty cool.
It's really a fun game. You play as a supervillain, one of six supervillains, and you start pretty small and weak, and you try and build up your reputation, your infamy scores, like you become more reputable in the criminal world. That allows you to recruit more henchmen and mercenaries and things like that. You sort of build up a team, and you sort of try and conquer the world continent by continent.
So you'd play this over days, or is this
no, we played
night?
It. The last time we played it was about 4 hours, okay. 4.5 hours.
You can build infamy and kick butt in
it's
night.
It's a very in-depth game. Uh-huh. I don't think it's quite along the lines of Dungeons & Dragons and that mm-hmm. type of thing, but it has a little bit in common with mm-hmm. those games, a little bit in common with Magic the Gathering, I guess, in that, again, it is about building your deck and your team, and mm-hmm. you know, if you're the type of person that really loves the story side of games, then it's perfect. I think people really enjoy it.
Well, I typed in Eagle Griffon, which is spelled Gryphon, but how can people find this? Is that the best way on Eagle?
It is. It's for sale on Eagle Griffon. Uh-huh. We have a board game festival coming up here in April, and the game will be available there. I think there will be at least 10 copies available. I'm going to try and come in for that. That festival is run by Aaron Hebert. I can't remember the exact name of the board game festival. It mm-hmm. may just be the Acadiana Board Game Festival, some version of that. Yeah. And I apologize about the name of it. I'm not involved in it. Uh-huh. I just know that Cajun Gamer, a local game and comic company that's going to be starting up here soon, I think they're opening this week. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a presence there, and they're going to be supporting the game.
Right.
So I will be there, and I'm happy to sign games while I'm in the room.
Yeah.
You know, it's always fun.
Right. Well, speaking of comics, I know you were involved in having Comic-Con. Look at Lafayette as its base in Louisiana, if you can share that story.
Absolutely.
And tell people what that is for some people that may not know.
Well, Comic-Con, it's sort of a generic term that's used by a lot of different conventions all over the country. This one's called the Louisiana Comic-Con, and I had originally met Greg Hanks as the main contact there that I was dealing with. I originally met him in Bossier City, Shreveport area, because they had done the show up there. And they did really an incredible job. Mm-hmm. The place was packed. It was well run. They were great with the crowd. Kind of fell in love with the guys. Greg and Jay just do a heck of a job promoting it and everything. And we had talked a little bit about doing a show here at some point, me and Rob, my office mate, and a few other people. But these guys did such a great job. We had considered the idea of pitching them to come and do a show down here. So it was already kind of on our minds. And then they actually approached us about doing a show in Baton Rouge. They were going to set up a new convention in Baton Rouge. And nothing against Baton Rouge and the people that love it, but I hate going there. I can't park. It's just a nightmare for me when I go, so I do try to avoid it as much as possible. So my first and foremost priority was to try and talk them out of moving to Baton Rouge. So we invited the guys here, showed them around. I introduced them to as many people as I could. You know, I knew Ben Berthelot a little bit. I knew Mark Mouton a little bit. Greg Gautreaux a little bit. Yeah, so I just started, I opened as many doors as I could. I know they got in to see the Cajun Dome while they were here in the convention center.
They like the food?
They did. They come back often for the food. They stuck around for a few days that weekend, and we brought them into the studio, kind of showed them some of the projects we were working on. And it just kind of worked out, and I think they've been happy here. The last I heard, the show pulls between 8,000 and 9,000 people, which is
big.
Great. And a typical medium-sized Comic-Con in the U.S. would be anywhere between 15,000 and 25,000, so they're on their way. Obviously, the big ones, the big Comic-Con, San Diego, New York Comic-Con, those are probably 200,000.
Wow.
They're pretty massive.
What do people do there? Like, what type of – I looked online. I saw Kevin Sorbo and different people. What is it? What is Comic-Con, though?
Comic-Con is really just a – it's different things to different people. So as a comic book creator, it's a chance for me to promote my work.
Okay.
People love to get their book signed, and I don't charge for that. So if, you know,
it's like
anyone,
fans. You can go meet people you follow.
If they support my work and they bring in a box of comics, I'm happy to sign them. You know, that's why I'm there. We do sketches for people and commissions. Some people like to dress up in costumes. That's a part of it. The celebrities are there. Some of them are there to make a buck, but a lot of them really are genuinely there to meet the fans. They just love doing it. If they have a window in their schedule where they can go out and do something, they love to, like I do, I like to do conventions all over because I get to see a new town and try new food and meet new people. It's just fun. And so a lot of the celebrities that come in are great. They really want to see the town. They want to go out. They want to, you know, what's the best restaurant? And I try to turn them on to the best po' boy. And, you know, it's always fun in the green room when you're sitting around talking. Sean Patrick Flannery had come in 2 years ago to the show. Never met him before. Super great guy. I found out that his grandfather was Cajun. So got to know him a little bit and kind of chat. And, you know, he would talk about eating boudin as a kid. And so I didn't know that about him. That was kind of interesting, you know. And then he ended up in the Houston area. So it's kind of funny when you make those little connections and you get to know people a little bit. But for me, that's what it's about. For other people, it's about very different things. There are people there that are just straight-up retailers, and they're pushing product. T-shirt designers, they'll have a wall full of great shirts they're trying to sell. And so it's a convergence of fandom, not just comic books, but of board games and all sorts of things.
So what you do, I guess you fit in multiple categories for this. I saw that you had written and illustrated for Marvel, DC, and others. Are you still doing that, or is that early
Sometimes.
Work?
I didn't grow up reading comics. I got started really late in comics, so I don't have the nostalgia for the characters.
You didn't go buy them like a pack of sack when you were little?
Never did, no.
Or whatever you had.
I had a cousin. He's still my cousin. I have a cousin who was a comic reader. I don't know if he still is, but he had comics. So every once in a while, I'd end up at his house and kind of flip through. But I never owned any. I never bought any until I was much older, probably 17 or 18. Around the time I started drawing, I started getting into comics around the same time. So, yeah, for me, it was a much later process for all that. So,
how did you get to draw for them, though, for Marvel, like these big names? How did you get in the door?
They typically, they just see stuff that I've done on other projects. You know, editors tend to be comic fans as well. Publishers tend to be comic book fans. Their books come out in the same shelf my books come out, so... We all know what each other's working on. It's a very small community.
Is it?
It very is a small community. We all know each other. We all know who to avoid, who not to work with, and who's doing a good job. And we all kind of track all that. And so for Marvel and DC, it's really just it depends on the books they like. If they think I'm right for something, I've had writers put in referral for me. But again, because I don't have the nostalgia for those characters, it's not a goal of mine. So. If and when projects do come in, I usually don't take it unless it's a smaller project, something a little more manageable in my schedule. So you'll typically see me pop up at Marvel in DC on a 5-page story or something like a 20 or 18-page story. So that's more manageable for me than some ongoing mm-hmm. book that's going to last 6 years.
Do you have a style? Like, is there a name for the way that you draw? Like, you know what I'm saying? Are you known for a certain type of art, at least in the comic realm?
No, some creators have a style that's their thing, and that's all they do. I tend to adapt a little bit based on the property. So if anyone's seen my work on Punks, the comic, mm-hmm. drastically different than Sweets, which is a murder mystery, homicide. Mm-hmm. That one's a little more realistic, a lot of darks and blacks, whereas Punks is kind of silly, cartoony photo collage. Mm-hmm. And every project's kind of like that. So the stuff I was doing with Halo on the Halo property was it's very clean and crisp because it's very sci-fi. You know, the environments are very sterile and clean. Uh-huh. So that's reflected in the artwork as well. So it kind of depends on the project.
I shared this with you. I had to look up your work because I did not know what Punks was, and we can get into Sweets in a minute. Mm-hmm. But I pulled this quote about Punks, the comic book, and I know that was something that you developed and promoted yourself, but you said many people assume the work is digital, but it's all done with actual photocopies and X-Acto blade and various things like tape and glue. And I looked
for
at the
sure,
pictures,
yeah.
So you would layer it like you cut and paste it?
Absolutely. It's photo collage,
uh-huh.
yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I have a really old laser photocopier, black and white, 11 by 17. It's kind of a piece of junk, but I have a guy that comes in and he keeps fixing it every time it breaks.
You probably couldn't replace it, huh?
I could probably find another cheap one, I imagine, uh-huh. if it did go down. It seems to be a pretty popular model. It's a Samsung, I think. I shoot photos, so it's all done with my camera, typically. Even the dog face, it was a neighbor behind one of the old places I lived had that dog, and uh-huh. so I did a lot of video and photos of the dog, and the fist is my fist in the book. And so it's a process of me kind of cleaning it up a little bit in Photoshop originally when I pull the photos in mm-hmm. just to adjust the levels, and I print it all out, photocopy it to various sizes and shapes and cut it out with a blade uh-huh. and glue it all down. And it's all black and white when it's done. And so I scan the black and white page, and I do digital colors.
That's so cool.
So it's a bit of a hybrid
yeah.
on the style.
What is Punks about?
Punks is a comedy about four guys that share an apartment, Abe, Fist, Dog, and Abraham Lincoln. These four guys, they beat each other up a lot in really fun ways. It's a comedy. It's a parody in a lot of ways.
It's silly, huh? Like, it's just
It is. We get compared fun. A lot to Adult Swim. If people are familiar with that, but we actually did come out before Adult Swim, so you know maybe they stole from us, I guess. But if anyone has ever seen the BBC show The Young Ones, we get compared favorably to uh-huh. that as well, which is a really funny
yeah.
BBC comedy, again about four guys that share an apartment. So,
mm-hmm. Are you one of the characters in your mind?
I'm all the characters.
You are?
Yeah, so they're all kind of a piece of me in some ways. That book was created with a really longtime collaborator friend of mine, Josh Fialkoff. I had an idea for the imagery, the visual look of it, and he was a comedy writer. Mm-hmm. That's how I met him. I knew he was a great comedy writer. So I had these characters on paper, and I didn't know what to do with it, and so I called him up, and I said, hey, I want to do this weird punk rock thing of collage, and I don't know if it made any sense to him at all. And he said he actually had a story about a band, a punk rock band, that he wanted to maybe try. So we tried to smush these two things together, and it just didn't fit. The collaboration didn't mm-hmm. work. And, you know, it was kind of, okay, we'll just kind of let it die. It's not going to work out. He went home, kind of revisited the artwork again, and created a whole kind of new thing based on the art I had mm. sent in. So
that's good.
It's been a great collaboration ever since. We brought it back a few times. It's a passion project of ours. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, in an industry dominated by superheroes, to do a story about four guys in an apartment.
I love
it. It's a little bit offbeat.
Yeah. It's like a TV sitcom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Josh has since gone on to write. He mostly writes television now for NBC, CBS,
oh, okay.
that type of thing. So,
mm-hmm. And then the other story we were talking about, Sweets, a New Orleans crime story that was set, I guess, after Katrina. Is that right? If you can talk about that.
Yeah, I actually started writing it before Katrina.
Okay.
And I had the idea, the general idea of the mystery, the murder mystery. It's a murder mystery along the lines of what you might see on HBO or Showtime, something like that. It's a little more adult. There's some violence and things like that in it. So I had the initial idea for the murder mystery, and I was kind of writing it, and it was set in New Orleans. And then Katrina happened, and I kind of went, okay, wait a minute, do I need to revisit this? And so I had lived through a couple hurricanes. The biggest one was Andrew when I was in mm-hmm. Thibodeau.
Mm-hmm.
pretty devastating storm, did a lot of damage. You know, I remember kind of walking outside I slept in my friend's apartment that night because we lived in the trailer. And he had a nice brick apartment. Yeah. So I went sleep at his place for the night, slept in the hallway. So it was pretty rough coming out. Nothing on the level of Katrina, but from those experiences, I realized that this concept, the idea of the storm, has never really been done well in comics ever that I can recall. And we have a major event here going on in New Orleans. And right at that time, I was thinking about it, Rita hit this area. Mm-hmm. So kind of a 1-2 punch. So I really had no choice but to kind of revisit the story that was in progress. I already had the concept of a murder mystery. And then I remember watching a news report where it was immediately after the storm, there were some families that had a real case. And they were wondering what was going on with their case, and they couldn't get any answers. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was kind of chaos after the storm.
Well, the evidence was all exactly.
It was just chaos.
Yeah.
And so I got to thinking about the mystery I was writing. I was like, this is a terrible thing. Like, imagine being a family with an open case mm-hmm. and the storm comes down. And that gave me the idea to try and write this mystery as if the storm coming was the deadline. So now we had a murder mystery with a ticking time bomb scenario. If this cop doesn't solve the crime before the storm hits, he's going to lose evidence and witnesses in the evacuation. It's going to be a nightmare. So he sees this coming. We know it's a big storm. We know it's going to hit. We don't know the extent of it yet. As the audience, we do because we've seen mm-hmm. the news, but the detective doesn't know. But he sort of senses it, that it's going to be big. It's going to be a major event. And so the pressure is really on to try and solve this crime before the event takes place. So it did add another level to it, but it also allowed me the opportunity to include some of the reality that is the hurricane prep and the evacuations and the chaos, and because I've lived that many times. And I was able to, I think, treat that respectfully in a way that mm-hmm. was original and highly creative in a work of fiction that I hadn't seen done before.
Did you handle all aspects of Sweets, the writing?
Right, that's a solo book. So I did
artistry.
Right, I did story, pencils, inks, colors, mm-hmm. lettering, logo, mm-hmm. book design, did the whole thing. Andrew Brinkley, longtime friend of mine, came in to do the editing for me. Mm-hmm. Because as a creator-owned project, we actually have to hire our own editor if we want it, you know, because I own the book. So I brought him on. He did an amazing job, you know, spot-checking me, my proofreader. He really kind of helped because sometimes, you know, the cliche of you can't see the forest or the trees is very
right.
true.
We don't catch our own mistakes.
Yeah, I'll rewrite a scene 8 or 9 times. I'm not even sure if it makes sense anymore. So I need fresh eyes. And yeah. so he kind of served that purpose for me. Mm-hmm. He was incredible.
So people can buy Sweets on Amazon?
There are some still on Amazon. It's currently out of print. The book did really well. And one of the pitfalls of a creator-owned work is that it's really up to me to kind of get it back up and running. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a one-man shop. And
you're
so,
busy. Yeah.
I'm pretty busy. I do have a new hardcover in the works as a plan to pull all that together in a very unique way. So I can't talk about it just yet, but there's a plan in effect right now on that project. And it's
going
to have some new life soon. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned to me when we were getting to know each other on the phone that most artists start, I guess comic book or just artists start when they're little, around 5, and that wasn't your story. What happened when you were 18-ish to get you to start drawing?
Yeah, most kids draw when they're little. I probably did to some degree, no more than any other kid, you know.
But you didn't know, like, this is what
No, so I have an older brother. His name's Kurt. And as a kid growing up, he drew all the time, and he was incredible. He's a really great artist. In fact, a fun little anecdote, I see family of mine often, and they'll tell me that they have a piece I drew when I was a kid. And
really?
I said, no, you don't.
It's
and
Kurt's.
They'll pull it out, and my brother's name is on it. Because at some point, he quit drawing as much, and I picked it up around the age mm-hmm. of 17 or 18. He sort of passed the torch, I guess, in a way. But I remember always watching him draw. I had an Aunt Anne Anna that would always draw, and it was kind of magical to me. And I do remember trying a little bit and just mm-hmm. couldn't. I just couldn't do it.
So you
I
didn't
just
take
never,
art when you were little.
No, I never took art. Never learned any of it. But it always intrigued me. I was always fascinated by it. The interest was there. And late in high school, probably junior senior year, I started to dabble a little bit. I was on the drum line, you know, in marching mm-hmm. band. And so we do these little posters, and I started dabbling a little bit then. And going into college, as you do, you have to take a variety of courses, and one of them was a beginning drawing course as an elective. So I took that, and I just loved it. I was terrible, mm-hmm. but I loved it. And so I started looking at my career opportunities of, you know, what am I good at, and mm-hmm. what do I love and can I find some convergence. I was very good at math coming into college. I had placed out of several maths. My trigonometry calculus scores were incredible. And so I thought maybe I'd go into engineering.
Yeah.
I took some of those base level courses and hated it.
So you weren't happy, even though you were good at it.
That's right. That's right.
What did you get in art? Like, what, do you remember what grade you got in your first class?
Oh, I don't ever I don't remember making better than a C ever, even when I graduated college. You know, we butted heads a lot, me and the art professors, because they had different theories on art. Mm-hmm. And universities aren't typically friendly to commercial art. They're more about the fine art. And so I was pretty stubborn. They weren't going to talk me out of it. I was going to do what I was going to do no matter what. Some of the instructors were open to that. Some weren't. And so
and they had the power of the grade.
That's right. And so I don't know if that had some impact. I always assumed mm-hmm. it did. I didn't necessarily want to draw the things they wanted me to draw, you know.
Were you drawing like this, like what you do now? Were you?
Oh, no. My work was terrible for about 12 or 15 years.
Oh.
When I look through my old sketchbooks, there's a period, 8 or 9 year period, where I see no improvement at all.
Oh,
and then
no.
Maybe 10 or so years into doing it a lot. Mm-hmm. Maybe
you became an outlier. You got
Yeah, so I graduated in 1997. Mm-hmm. So probably 2006, 2007, 10 years after that, I finally started to see some improvement in those mm-hmm. old sketches. Kind of, okay, wait a minute. I was learning something here. This looks a little better. And it wasn't until 2008 when I actually got paid. So it's quite a hike.
Yeah.
You know, quite a hike into a career.
And all right here in Lafayette, right
here
in this
Lafayette,
area.
Yeah. And, you know, I always say people that start at the age of 5 have a pretty huge advantage, because I was trying to learn really fundamental mm-hmm. stuff at the age of 18 to 20 years old.
Yeah, and get through college.
Yeah.
And then you were having to support yourself.
That's right.
Yeah. So you were doing graphic design?
Yeah, I graduated with a BFA with advertising design. So I got into advertising. I worked for a few agencies here in town. I started at a small agency called Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy Marcotte and Megan Barra had founded it. Megan moved on to start her own studio, and I had the unfortunate job of trying to replace Megan Barra at an agency, which is so not something you ever want to do. She's pretty incredible.
Nancy's pretty kind, though.
Yeah, it was fun. I learned mm-hmm. a lot. And then we got bought by AKA, Kiki Freyard's company bought us. So I worked for Kiki for a while in advertising. Another great experience. Didn't have any real problems with any of it. It just I wanted to write and draw stories. I wanted to be a storyteller. And there weren't that many opportunities mm-hmm. for me in that world. So I started dabbling. I slowly kind of transitioned from advertising and design into comics by taking on small projects, a little bit bigger projects. Mm-hmm. And I would scale back to where I was starting to just freelance in advertising and design. So I would hop around Foster and Graham Group and all the agencies
yeah.
you probably know of, kind of just dabbling on projects they needed, filling in when someone was out with a baby and that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
while I was ratcheting up the comic book. So it was never a clean break. I never made a big jump. I just kind of slowly turned mm-hmm. the dial from left to right and made the move.
I read one of your interviews. You mentioned that you never had like that one break, one big thing that changed everything. You just kept on doing what you were doing. Was that tough?
No, I don't think it was tough. I mean, I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the reason I eventually got good at it and stuck with it was because I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. You know, anytime I talk to people that want to maybe do this stuff, I kind of ask them, I was like, you know, if you have downtime on a Saturday, are you drawing? And mm-hmm. if they say no, they're probably not right for this job. You know, you really mm-hmm. have to enjoy it or you'll never get good at it. You'll never improve.
Yeah.
Even natural ability, you know, if you don't enjoy doing the work, you're going to probably play video games instead of working on a book, and then the book doesn't come out and you're in trouble,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I think you do have to enjoy the process of it. So
right.
even at home, we have a show on or something. I'll often have the sketchbook out. I'm doodling something. I'm drawing with my son all the time. He's 8 years old. He's got 2 books published, and he's got about 7 T-shirts out. Yeah.
What kind of books?
The first book is called Jungle Adventure or something, and it's about the hero's kind of swinging on a vine and kind of slips and falls and lands in a puddle, and it's cute kind of fun thing.
Yeah.
And he brought a copy in for his
Lucas.
Teacher, and the teacher put it in the library at school.
Uh-huh.
So he's got a book in the library there. And then the second book is about a bird and a turtle, and they play hide and seek, and the turtle goes and hide with some mm-hmm. rocks, and really kind of cute, fun kid stuff. But
that's an accomplishment.
It's great when
yeah.
he sits up at my comic convention sometimes with me and sells his books while I sell mine. And but it's our version of the lemonade stand.
Yeah, he enjoys it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we make little games together, and we have that creative time. And it's fun. He loves it doing it. I love doing it. So we keep it going.
Now, Cody, you could probably be anywhere doing what you're doing, including New York City, Los Angeles, other big markets.
For the stuff I do, publishing, absolutely, yeah. New York's the hot spot for that.
You chose to stay here. Can you talk about that, about Lafayette being your base?
I mean, clearly, it's a lot easier now with the internet. You know, had I attempted this even 20 years ago, it would have been pretty much impossible, I think. But with the internet, I mean, we do file transfers, you know, we do Dropbox and stuff like that. So the technology side of it has solved a lot of the problems of attempting to live anywhere. But even with that, I do find most people still tend to move to those hotspots because the work's no different. You still have to sit down at the drawing table and produce. You have to sit down with your note cards or tablets or laptops and write. Mm-hmm. The work's still the work. I think the reason a lot of people move, and the reason I didn't, the reason a lot of people move is they want that scene. They want the, you know, obviously if you're going to be a grip on set, you probably want to be in Los Angeles. But for comics, it's not necessarily that way. You don't have to be any particular location to do it. But people enjoy the community side of all that. And we don't have as much of that here. So instead of trying to move to find it, you know, for me, I just didn't really need it. I'm a self-motivator. Mm-hmm. And so that side of it is fun for me, but I didn't need it to be creative. And a lot of people, I think, feel like they do need it.
The networking, too, I would think, getting your foot in the door.
Yeah, well, that for me, that's solved by going to comic book conventions and things like that. So I still have that. I get the work out. I talk to people. Everyone kind of knows me in the industry. I know them. We all get along. You know, we have these little secret Facebook groups and all this kind of stuff goes on behind the scenes, you know. So all that's kind of still there.
I can imagine what that's like.
But, you know, you talk about someplace like, you know, Portland, Oregon is a really hot location for comic book creators. Los Angeles, obviously, New York City is another one. There are a few other little spots like that. Austin is another great spot. And the main thing they have, again, is the sort of the scene of that activity. And so as I started doing what I do for a living and I watch up-and-coming creators that I really thought were very impressive, time after time they move on, they move away. And so you know, for me, realizing that I don't need the scene as much, but a lot of people do, I have since started to kind of create some of that here. And so that's why we brought Comic-Con. That's one of the reasons why I stole it from Baton Rouge and brought it here.
Thank you.
We also do an art group. We have a, we call it the Drink and Draw Social Club. We meet up every Wednesday night.
Little motivation.
Yeah, we just hang out and we draw. I actually don't drink, but a lot of guys do. You know, we'll eat and we'll cut up and have fun. And there's no structure. There's no teaching. It's just, we bring our sketchbooks and we watch each other work, and you can really, I think, learn more by watching someone work than have them teach you, you know, just by observing. Mm-hmm. And so we do that every Wednesday night. We've built that up with the Comic-Con. I do workshops when I can. I have one coming up this weekend. Mm-hmm. So I attempt to do as much of that as I can to kind of help the scene. We started doing these little creative meetups at Rev downtown before Art Walk. So 5 o'clock before Art Walk. You know, we've been meeting up the last couple months, so if anyone's interested, that'd be a great time to come out and try to do some of that. But, you know, a lot of the stuff that we did have established for our creative scene here has kind of dwindled. The Advertising Federation's mostly shuttered. Backstory was a filmmaking group that was in town that's not really active. AIGA, which is a graphic design organization, they were around when I was in school and then fizzled. They flared up a little bit recently and then fizzled again, and so I do think that stuff's important, and believe it or not, I think it's a primary reason why people leave is the community aspect of what we're doing. And so I've been working hard to try and build some of that stuff up, and I know a lot of other people are too, but you know, if and when we're going to attempt to put attention on something, no one ever looks at that, and I think it's the primary thing.
Our food and music has a big,
we have it great for food and music, absolutely.
And even then, it can be a struggle making it in the industry, but you do have cohorts. But you're right, the creative, I guess the graphic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know how many music organizations we have. There's just so much all the time, you know. Now I know there's a songwriting event that comes through town, and Festival International. There's probably 12 major festivals in the area all dedicated to music. And because of that, that's a big reason why our musicians stick around. They're not all in Nashville. right? I think that's a big part of that. We have the studios here, the recording studios, and there's industry support coming from every direction. So when it comes to the entertainment arts, you know, the state and the community have done things like tax incentives and things like that, and that's all helpful in some ways. But we put little to no effort on the community side of the creative arts that I do. I do entertainment art. I don't necessarily do fine art. Even the fine art world.
Art Walk is really for drawings and pictures.
That's right. Art Walk is a great event for fine arts. The ACA is in town. They do an incredible job. We have a lot of great, the Hilliard, incredible museum. You know, we have, I mean, they're state of the art over there. But as far as entertainment arts, it's kind of just me, you know? And so I'm out there pushing. I'm, you know, we got Comic-Con now, so that's a supportive industry. There is stuff flaring up. There's a new children's book group that's been meeting up, which is awesome. They're meeting at the Southside Library. I don't remember the dates, but
your son does that? Does he participate?
No. I did go to a few of the meetings. I don't do a lot of stuff for kids. My stuff tends to be a little bit more adult. But I do have a young reader project that I'm starting to kind of work on. So I'll probably start making an appearance at the children's book group again. But we do need that stuff. We need a lot more of it. And if there's a chance for people to get involved and support it, even if you just want to sponsor it in some way or something, I encourage people to do that. Because if you want to know why our young talent leaves that are in the entertainment world, that's it.
Right. For people that want to get in touch with you, is there a place or an email or your website? Where
yeah,
would people
go? I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all under my name, Cody Chamberlain with a
K-O-D-Y.
K-O-D-Y. You can also go to inkhousecreative.com.
They can reach
contact,
out to you.
I don't remember what I have listed, but I know I have a contact form. At least my email may be up there. Probably don't call. I don't answer the phone. I'll reply to a text or return calls later, but I usually don't answer it.
How did I reach out to you? Was it LinkedIn? You responded.
LinkedIn, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty cool because we didn't know each other.
Yeah, LinkedIn has a really interesting dynamic where you can, again, like the referral thing we're talking about.
It's more credible.
Interesting thing about it to me is you can sort of see if there's a person you want to reach out to or something you're looking at, you can punch it in the search and sort of see who else you know that's connected to that. That's the most impressive thing to me about that service. The front page with all the blogging, and I don't really pay much attention to that, but the networking component of it, I think, is really interesting.
Right. Well, Cody Chamberlain, I want to thank you so much for taking time today to share your story on Discover Lafayette. I'm very hopeful that this interview will spur some interest in what you're doing and maybe build this community that you'd like to see built for the creative arts.
You know, we have the Board Game Festival coming up, and I'm planning to be there, and then Comic-Con in March. So.
Right. Well, best wishes on everything you're doing, on the success for your board game, Maniacal, and I know you've got a great future. It's just unfolding for you. I want to thank our listeners, too, for being with us, for listening to Cody Chamberlain's story. And I'd like to also thank James Hebert for taping this today at KRVS. And again, to our sponsors, both Jiberia Bank and Lafayette General. We couldn't do this without your support. And, of course, Raider Solutions has been such a big proponent of ours. We thank you for all of your support. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift.